Jasoda Nandana Rajajana Ranjana Jamuna Tira Vanachari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari Jaya Om Vishnu Paya Paramahamsa Parivraja Gacharya Ashutara Shatashi Srimadha Sivayana Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada Ki Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Samvita Bhakta Brinda Ki Nitai Gopramandi. All glories to the Assembled Devotees. All glories to Sri Sri Guru and Gauranga. Om Akyant Mirantasya Yena jana shalakaya chakshurun militam yena tasmai shri guruve namaha shri chaitanya mano bhishtam stapitam yena bhutale swayam rupakadamayam dadati swapadantikam vancha kaputurubhyascha ripasindubhyarevacha Patita nam pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo namo namaha Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shri Vasari Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare O Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya O Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya O Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya And Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 5, Chapter 8, Text Number 17.
Apikshema nasmin ashramam pavane sashpani tarantam deva guptam drakshami.
Word to word meaning api, it may be.
Kshemena,
with fearlessness, because of the absence of tigers. And other animals.
Asmin,
in this,
Ashrama Upavane,
Garden of the Hermitage,
Shashpani, Charantam,
walking and eating the soft grasses,
Devaguptam,
being protected by the demigods,
Drakshami,
shall I see? Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada Kijai. Alas, is it possible that I shall again see this animal protected by the Lord and fearless of tigers and other animals? Shall I see again him wandering in the garden eating soft grass? Purport, Maharaj Bharata thought that the animal was disappointed in his protection and had left him for the protection of a demigod. Regardless, he ardently desired to see the animal again within his ashram, eating the soft grass and not fearing tigers and other animals. Maharaj Bharata could think only of the deer and how the animal could be protected from all kinds of inauspicious things. From the materialistic point of view, such kind thoughts may be very laudable. But from the spiritual point of view, the king was actually falling from his exalted spiritual position and unnecessarily becoming attached to an animal. Thus degrading himself, he would have to accept an animal body. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Hare Krishna. So the basic point that's being mentioned in this section is the material energy has many ways in which it captures the bewildered conditioned souls and keeps them captivated in the material energy. And we're quite familiar with many of their classic weapons. It's not like Maya comes up with new weapons. All the weapons are mentioned in the Shastras. There are no new tricks that Maya has. It's not like you hear about something that Maya hasn't already used extensively discussed in the Shastras in the contemporary world. There are no new tricks to Maya. It's just the same old tricks keeping the conditioned souls captivated birth after birth. So we're hearing about some of those. We hear about these weapons of Maya by which she keeps the living entities captivated. And we're quite familiar with many of them, such as the sex desire. That weapon is one of the classic, powerful weapons that keeps the living entities captivated. In this section, we're hearing about another weapon of Maya's that keeps the living entity quite bewildered. And that's the idea. She generates the idea within the living entity that he can be an independent shelter for some other jiva. And this one is also a quite prominent way in which Maya keeps the souls bewildered. Where the jivas, 1/10,000 the tip of the hair, we hear like this from the Shastra, very insignificant, so small it cannot be seen by any material device. And yet such a small, insignificant living entity is thinking he can be the shelter for another living entity, an independent shelter from God. And this is one of the ways that Maya keeps the souls captivated in the material world, by generating this idea that I have to protect some other living entity. I have to do it. Without me, this living entity will be without shelter. They will be hopeless, and harm will easily come to them. And inauspiciousness will come upon them if I do not give the protection. This is a very classic weapon. So it manifests in many different ways. And for example, if you become a family person, then it is very easy. This is one of the dangers of, you can say, the grihastha ashram, griha medhi ashram, is that one becomes the man of the house, right? You say like this. And the idea, the dangerous idea in this is that one thinks, I am the protector, I am the provider, I am the maintainer, I am the controller, and I am the enjoyer. Just by adopting that one identity as the husband, one gets bewildered by all these ideas that I am the maintainer, I am the protector. If I am not there, who will be there to protect the family? One is thinking in this way. And one that is also just, that is moral, that is correct also. One thinks is a very valid way of thinking. Or one becomes a preacher, and one thinks that without my powerful influence through my words, then the living entities would not be uplifted. If I do not preach, how would they be benefited? And this way, one may fail to see that he needs to do so much self-improvement himself before he goes and dives into the lake of saving the conditioned souls. And prematurely, sometimes it is seen that we may prematurely dive into the ocean of material existence to save the conditioned souls and find ourselves drowning and needing shelter in the name of giving protection to those living entities. This is a prominent, and so it manifests in many different ways, and we're hearing about that now. Bharata Maharaj was thinking in this way, how without me, this living entity will be protected. So here he's feeling bewildered that maybe this living entity was not satisfied with my shelter. So now he's taking shelter of some demigod or something. But still, I'm wanting him to come back, and he's thinking in this way. So in this way, one becomes degraded. Prabhupada says in the purport that this may be considered very laudable from the material perspective. Someone's going all out to protect some insignificant souls. He himself is insignificant, and he's going out to provide shelter for other living entities. And Generally, that is considered very laudable. I remember during 9/11, all those men who went back into the building to save some people from the towers that were falling, they got so much news coverage, and you know, people were buying them tickets to travel all around the world to tell their courageous story. You know, and they wouldn't do anything, but they maybe saved like one person. But because they went back inside and took that risk of saving one person, they got so much glorification and so on. So in the material world, it's considered very laudable, actually. To try to play God is considered very laudable. To try to be the controller and then the provider and maintainer. But from the spiritual perspective, it is one of the most degrading ways to programs to the consciousness. Because by such thought processes, you actually usurp the position of God, who's the actual protector. By such thinking, one is thinking that actually, inadvertently, one may be thinking that God is not able to do so. God has made a mistake in the way of managing the living entities. This is the idea of all these philanthropic programs that pop up that Prabhupada would criticize. Many times people find it very annoying that devotees don't have a higher appreciation for altruistic activities and philanthropic work. They find that quite obnoxious. I've mentioned this many times when I first joined the temple, and one young Christian boy came to the temple. I was talking to him, Sunday feast time, it was many years ago. And he said, do you all do any welfare? He was asking several questions. And he said, do you all do any welfare work? And I said, we do the highest welfare work, you know, preaching Christian consciousness. That was my idea. And he said, no. Do you do any lower welfare work? He asked just like that. And I said, what do you mean, like opening hospitals and feeding people and clothing them? He said, yes, that welfare work. And so I asked him, I said, well, are you doing? And he said, yes, I am doing. I said, so it's already covered. So we're doing the highest welfare work that is now being neglected by so much of society, that welfare work of spreading Christian consciousness. He wasn't satisfied with my answer, but I was happy that I said like that. Sometimes people find fault that devotees don't have a higher appreciation. But in fact, by such a mentality, outside of what Krishna has instructed us to do, such a mentality may actually put us in opposition with the Supreme Lord inadvertently. By thinking to oneself that the Lord has made a mistake in his way of managing the living entities. Oftentimes people feel that way when they hear about the law of karma. The question comes up, why are there so many material inequities in the material world? And other traditions they answer that question very inadequately on account of not accepting the doctrine of karma. They come to devotees, and devotees, we have a very nice explanation. We say the law of karma. And many times I've heard the question come up, well, couldn't God come up with a better way of managing things? They think in this way. Isn't there a more precise way where people wouldn't have to suffer so much and so on? So they think in this way, putting themselves in opposition with the Supreme Lord, that they could be a better protector. It would be a better way of actually caring for the living entities than what God is doing. And therefore, making so many big programs for distribution of food and so on because God made a mistake. And in the way he allowed these entities in this part of the country to suffer so much, he made a mistake. So we have to step in and rectify the mistake that God has made. Now it may not be articulated in that way, but the mentality is very much like that. When you're trying to do compassionate work outside of the parameters which are set up by the Lord, then inadvertently that's what ends up happening to the mentality. And it is often observed that people who feel this intense compassion for other living entities outside of the parameters that have been given by the Lord and the way we should be expressing compassion, they end up actually becoming more atheistic. Because the suffering in the material world is quite intense. In America, we don't see so much of it yet. I'm sure it's coming up in the future. Our karma is just, you know, building up, coming. But right now, we don't see so much of suffering as they do in other parts of the world. Sometimes people travel to other parts of the world. I had this experience going in Ohio and meeting one girl who had went to India to do some welfare activity. And when she saw the types of miserable conditions in India, she inquired for me, how can you believe in God when you see things like that? That was her question. Driven by her compassion for the living entities, she got doubt about the existence of the Supreme Lord. So that can, and similarly in the first chapter, second chapter of Bhagavad Gita, it is mentioned how Arjuna was overwhelmed by compassion. And Prabhupada's purport is that such compassion is and lamentation is meant for Shudras. Because it does not consider the eternal soul at all. It does not consider the benefit of the eternal soul at all. So sometimes someone may ask a question, okay, law of karma is there, but how do you explain children being killed in natural disasters? You know, children are innocent, so they say. They have not done any activity. So, and no one's killed them. So, okay, if someone else has killed them, you can say that person's mentality was off. But what about natural disasters and so on? How would you explain that? So, and of course, our answer remains the same. Not callously, but philosophically, that is the law of karma. And they say, well, then the question comes, well, how can they learn from that? Because they're children. What do they benefit from having such an experience? You know, if you're older and you're criminal-minded, you suffer the reactions of your criminal activity, you can learn from that and grow. That would be our general understanding of the law of karma. But what is it? What are living to getting by dying so young in a natural disaster? This question I heard asked also to one of our senior devotees. And how might we answer that question? So this is, in other words, they don't consider the soul in their analysis, that the soul has an eternal existence, and that the manifestation of distress in the material world is actually meant to teach the soul wisdom. Whether or not the living entity remembers the exact events, they do remain in the mind as impressions. I think this is probably done even in modern psychology, where you can have an experience when you're very young, let's say like an experience of drowning, and you don't remember it when you get older, but your parents remember it. And because of that experience in your youth, you're hydrophobic. You're very afraid to come near water. Now, you don't know where that mentality is coming from, but you're very afraid. And then your parents can later on tell you it's because you had an experience of drowning when you were young. And therefore, that remained as an impression in the mind. Although you don't remember the specific event, the impression remains in the mind, and it governs the mentality that you have now in relationship to water in that example. So similarly, the experiences that the jivas get in the material world, particularly the experiences of distress, they're actually meant to teach the soul wisdom. Sometimes this problem of evil question comes up. This is one of the main attacks against theism. If there is a God, then how can there be so much of suffering? But Krishna answers that question very nicely in chapter 2 of Bhagavad Gita by explaining that the soul doesn't actually suffer at all. Because the soul is not a product of matter, so it's not actually possible for the soul to suffer. Actually, factually suffer. Just like when you're dreaming, you may have a nightmare, but you're not factually suffering. There's an experience of suffering within the mind, but the actual fact is that you're sleeping, well, not peacefully, but you're sleeping in your bed, and nothing's actually happening to you. So similarly, that's just in the dream state, and now this is the waking state, which is also very much like a dream, but it's the waking state of consciousness. And nothing's actually happening to the soul. He's just an observer who's identifying with that reality. Just like when you're dreaming, you're just an observer that's identifying with the dream and thus gaining some experience by dint of that identification. So also in the waking state, this is also another dream. Prabhupada said one is a night dream, one is a daydream. And the daydream lasts for a long time. And you go to sleep and it continues for a long time. But it's a daydream. And by identification with the dream, you get some experience. Just like when many of you may have watched sports before coming into the Christian consciousness movement, sports or movies, and movies for sure. Sports are more intense. Does anyone here like sports growing up? Watching sports, basketball, or anyway, in Chicago, the Chicago Bulls were a very powerful team. And I don't know how old it was, in the 90s, right? They won like so many championships in a row and so on. Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen. Anyway, sorry to remind you of these mundane names. So we had this experience when watching the championships. I remember one championship where the Bulls were down. I don't remember the details, but I remember the Bulls were down by 1 point. And there was like 30 seconds left in the game, you know? So there's a high intensity, you know, and we're from Chicago, so we were wanting the Bulls to win. So when you're watching, you're like gritting your teeth and your face is stuck in the screen. You're in total anxiety. That has nothing to do with you. You're perfectly okay. You're in your room. You're in your house. It has absolutely nothing to do with you. But you're gritting biting your nails, and your mind is willing. And, you know, here Scottie Pippen passes the ball to Michael Jordan. You're just watching the screen. You're in anxiety. And finally, there's 10 seconds left. And the Bulls are still down by one, and They finally pass the Jordan, and he shoots a three, and they win by two. And there's great ecstasy. You know, and then you celebrate with your family. Everyone starts drinking alcohol and so on, eating meat, and there's great happiness. That experience actually has nothing to do with you. It has nothing to do with you. The people who are actually going through that, they don't know about your existence. They don't care about your existence. It has nothing to do with you, but by dint of identification with it, you're getting so much experience. You're experiencing anxiety. And so on. Although factually nothing is really happening to you, it's an experience created by the mind. So similarly, our experiences in the material world do not actually cause any harm to the soul whatsoever, because the soul is completely transcendental. Uddhava will later on ask this question to Krishna in the Bhagavatam. Who actually suffers? The body can't suffer because the body is inert matter. And the soul can't suffer because the soul is totally transcendental. So how is it possible to experience suffering at all? Uddhava asks this question to Krishna. It's a very profound question. How is it possible? If the soul is transcendental, and he's Prakriti, we hear, completely different from matter. And matter is inert, so who is actually experiencing the suffering? In so many words, Krishna explains it's the mind that's generating that experience. So factually, nothing's happening to the soul, but the mind is creating some experience, and the soul's consciousness is projected through the mind. He's identifying with that, and therefore he's experiencing something. So this is our explanation. So some people have this question about the problem of evil, but actually there's no problem at all, because the soul cannot factually suffer in the slightest. So then why does God create a situation where the soul thinks he's experiencing all this misery? And the whole purpose is so the soul will take shelter of Krishna. That's the whole point, that suffering in the material world, since nothing's actually happening to the soul, the experience or the virtual, it's like a virtual reality. The virtual experience of suffering is actually meant to cause the jiva's consciousness to go direct towards God. That's the purpose of the experience. And it generally takes many lifetimes for the living entity to gain that wisdom, that I should take shelter of the Supreme Lord, that actually he's my only protector. It generally takes lifetimes for the living entity to gain that wisdom, lifetimes of suffering and the impressions of suffering in the mind. So that in one fine birth, the idea comes up, you know, to hell with this program. I'm tired of this suffering, you know. Is there a goal of life? Is there a God? Is there a supreme shelter by which my heart can be eternally solaced? That question doesn't come up until the soul gains sufficient experience and wisdom through the experience. This is why Krishna teaches about the soul. Chapter 2 is a very profound chapter. Because why is Krishna teaching about the soul? One reason Krishna teaches about the soul is to counteract Arjuna's argument of compassion. Because Arjuna's first argument in the Bhagavad Gita in chapter 1 is that he didn't want to fight out of compassion for the living entities on the other side of the field, and also on his side. That was his first argument. Very noble, very classic, beautiful argument. Prabhupada said laudable, In fact, I remember meeting a student one time at DePaul University. She took a Bhagavad Gita from me one day, and I used to stand in the same corner every day with the hope of meeting the same students and trying to cultivate them. And she came to me the next day, and she had already read all the way through chapter 1, some of chapter 2. And she inquired from me. She said, you know, in chapter 1, Arjuna was a very nice guy. He was a very good guy. She told me like this. And she said, now Krishna is starting to speak to him and he's becoming contaminated. She told me like this. Huh? He was giving such good points. Compassion, you know, destruction of the dynasty and the sinful activity. He's giving such a noble person. And now Krishna's trying to convince him to fight, do such an ignoble, horrible activity. What is your explanation? So this is how people think, a classic conditioned soul question. You know, Arjuna is actually being totally irresponsible, as Krishna points out in the beginning of chapter 2, by wanting to abandon his duty at the crucial moment. It's just like, it is very much like this, in fact. Someone is being accosted, let's say like a young girl is being accosted by some 500-pound, you know, ghetto person. And obviously, I'm not going to be able to do much with this body. So then I call the police, naturally, because I'm not going to go and say, hey, stop it. He, you know, kills me and then continues his program. So then I call the police, and they come, and at the crucial moment of stopping him, he decides to meditate and become peaceful. I'm going to the yoga studio. I need to just look within my heart right now and introspect. At the crucial moment, she's being attacked, you know, and something needs to happen right away. You don't expect that the police are going to come and, you know, tap him on the back. I mean, sir, can you stop beating her? You know, you're going to expect that they're going to come with their bats and immediately start attacking and ask questions later, right? That would be a responsible police officer in that situation. But right at that crucial moment, he decides to meditate. You know, he gets out of the police car and he just suddenly has a change of heart. I think I'm going to sit and meditate. Then he becomes a criminal, actually. He can actually go to prison for irresponsible behavior. Arjuna's situation is very similar. So Krishna's chastising him. He's shocked. Where is this contamination coming from? He's actually shocked to see this. Anarya Jushtam. Krishna says, this is Anarya Jushtam. Anarya Jushtam means where you give greater predilection to your emotions than to your actual duty. This is called Anarya Jushtam. Prabhupada explains in the purport very nicely. Anarya Jushtam means that you have a certain responsibility you're supposed to carry out, but then the mind is producing an emotional experience which is contrast thing to the actual duty supposed to perform, and you give greater weight to your emotional experience than to your duty. That's called the Narya Jushtam. So Krishna is very shocked to see this happening to Arjuna. And he says, you're choosing this way right at the crucial moment. It would have been one thing if it was like several days before the war and you were having doubts and, you know, you went to Krishna, I had to talk about it. Krishna, why is this? I'm having doubts. I don't know if I want to do this. But right at the crucial moment, an hour before the battle is supposed to begin, I don't want to do this. It's very irresponsible behavior. It's criminal activity, actually. And Krishna chastises Arjuna, saying, give up this weakness of heart. But the girl from Dipal, she says that just the opposite. She says Arjuna was a nice guy, and Krishna's influence made him contaminated. She was saying like this. So this is due to a lack of understanding of the real principles governing existence. So then, my original point was that, so Krishna teaches Atmagyan to counteract Arjuna's compassion argument, which is his first argument. Another reason Krishna teaches Atmagyan is because by such knowledge, you will gain sufficient detachment from matter to learn from your experiences within the material world. Without sufficient detachment, your experiences don't produce wisdom. When you're too attached, therefore we hear oftentimes that insanity means to do the same thing in the same way and expect a different result. This is the definition of insanity. So when one is without sufficient spiritual knowledge, he doesn't have the sufficient detachment to learn from his experiences and gain wisdom. But when he has spiritual knowledge, Atmagyan doesn't mean realize. Here in chapter 2, it's not realized knowledge. It's just the theoretical framework of the knowledge. Just by that knowledge, that can gain you sufficient detachment from your experiences to gain wisdom. And you see it, devotees, we see it amongst devotees all the time. When they're suffering, they'll say, Prabhu, I'm being purified today. Although they don't, you know, purification is a synonym for extreme suffering. And we don't want to say I'm suffering because that would be bad preaching Krishna consciousness. We say I'm being purified, Prabhu. Today is an extreme level of purification. That's our general language. So you see that, but that devotee has that knowledge. So when he's going through an experience, instead of just, of course the mind is going to complain. That's the general drift of the material mind. But when the soul has that wisdom, his intelligence can actually fight against that and actually gain wisdom from the experience by which he can gain stronger impetus to surrender to Krishna. So Krishna teaches Atmagyan also to inspire the soul with detachment from his experience. Right? Krishna, in so many words, is saying that. By this knowledge, how can you, Arjuna, know that the soul who is indestructible, immeasurable, and so on, cause anyone to kill or kill anyone? So in other words, he's telling Arjuna, you should be detached from it. This is your duty. And it's going to look like killing and counter-killing is going on, but how can you, who know about the soul, accept that illusion? Because you know the difference between matter and spirit, so how can you accept that that's what's happening? Obviously, Arjuna's killing someone, right? And he's causing others to kill and so on. That's the superficial framework. But Krishna says, how can you, who know about Atmagyan, who knows the difference between matter and spirit, think in that way? So the point is that Krishna is teaching us to detach us from the very real illusion that we identify with. So that through that experience, we gain the wisdom by which we surrender to Krishna more. So, of course, Bharata Maharaj had this knowledge, as would be expected for someone on the platform of Bhava. He obviously had this base. This is rudimentary spiritual knowledge, Atmagyan. And Bhava is a perfectional state. So Bharata Maharaj had this knowledge. And still he came under the sway of this idea that I have to be the protector of other living entities. There's a reason for this, but we're not discussing that reason now because it's coming up later. But the basic point is that Maya is very strong. So although Krishna teaches this knowledge in order to detach us, it is something like when you see a mirage of water in the desert. Once you nullify it as anything substantial, it's not that the mirage disappears. Although you know, okay, that's a mirage of water, is insubstantial, but it doesn't disappear just because you've nullified this substantiality. It still appears that the water, the mirage still is there. So at any point, the doubt may come up. Maybe it's something there. Because it doesn't disappear. It would be very convenient if you realized it was insubstantial and it just vanished. And you're like, whew, that was a close call. But it is not like it disappeared. You nullify its substantiality, but it still is there glaring in your face. So similarly, we hear about the illusory world and we gain spiritual knowledge, but it's still right in our face. So at any point, it can be, again, captivating. Until you're out of the material world, there's always danger of being captivated by the material existence. Even if you're a jiva mukta soul, this is mentioned even in Chaitanya Charitamrita, chapter 24 of the Majjhalila. Even if you're jiva mukta, you can commit offense and then again become implicated in the illusory attraction. This is, in fact, one reason that Jiva Goswami gives about Bharata Maharaj getting again attracted to the material energy due to the nam aparad. Anyway, so although we may nullify the substantiality of material existence, because it's glaring in our face, at any moment it can again captivate us by illusory concepts. So therefore, it's mentioned that there's danger at every step in the material world. All of a sudden you get crazy, isn't it? All of a sudden you go crazy, especially in the stage of sadhana. You're doing good, you're chanting your rounds for months together, you know, nicely, according to our estimation. And things are going on, and then all of a sudden you go wild. The mind just goes wild all of a sudden. And you start seeing faults everywhere. And then all of a sudden the sex desires seeming very much more appealing. And then classes that speak out against it seem less appealing. And so all of a sudden the mind goes crazy. Because that is the nature of the material existence. We're still in it. And until you're out of it, it's still very dangerous. So therefore, there can only be one shelter in this material world. That's Krishna. I was looking at a verse here from the Bhagavatam that's very nice, that Uddhava speaks to Krishna expressing these many points about Krishna being our only protector. I thought I might go through some of the verse with you. Anyway, the Nirvana Dhir Aham Uhe, Rajinabhi Tapto, he's making this point that because of I'm grown weary of the material existence, Nirvana Dhir, I'm grown weary of the material existence and I'm tormented by endless distresses. And as a result of this, I've been forced to consider surrendering to Krishna. That's what in the commentary mentions like this. Because of being exhausted and discouraged. And by material existence is very discouraging. Probably all the more so when you're a sadhaka. When you're in ignorance, they say ignorance is bliss, right? You don't even know what's going on. You're so miserable that you don't even know how miserable you are. It's just like when a person who's alcoholic, who's drunk. He's so drunk, he doesn't even know what's happening. I actually saw that on the train yesterday. A guy was so drunk, he was about to fall off the platform. And he's such in a miserable condition, he's completely unaware of his situation. But then when you become Krishna conscious, you become aware of how miserable you are. Therefore, Vidura says this point in the Bhagavatam. He says there are two people who are happy in this world, those who are completely ignorant and those who are completely enlightened. And that middle person, the sadhaka, he suffers a lot. Because he's aware of how much miserable material existence is. So we oftentimes find ourselves discouraged, and especially in practicing Krishna consciousness, we're very discouraged many times. Easily discouraged, isn't it? You have this experience, you get easily discouraged. Maya gives one little slap and you're ready to just call it quits. You know, we've been practicing for such a short time, and we're bewildered. Why isn't enlightenment coming faster? Or sometimes, with the most discouraging thing is when you feel that you're getting a lot of enlightenment. Somehow the, you know, material desires are not accosting you so much, and you feel like kind of solid. You chanted your rounds without sleeping for a whole one month. And you feel that the Nishta platform must be arising now, and Ruchi is coming very soon thereafter. And then, you know, you're going along very kind of like Utsuhamayi, kind of proud. And inadvertently, again, these types of qualities don't, it's not like they're obviously in the foreground of the consciousness. It happens very subtly. And then all of a sudden, Maya slaps you with a powerful dream, which you cannot describe in the Bhagavatam class. And you come to Mangalarsi, and you're just like, you feel totally deflated, discouraged. Maya's business is to discourage us at every step, to keep us discouraged, so we won't surrender to Krishna. For Krishna, our narcissists are not that big of a deal. If it was a huge deal, then it wouldn't be possible to extinguish them with one chanting of the holy name. That's how insignificant sins are. And that doesn't mean going sinning and grinning like a Christian. I mean, the modern Christians or modern devotees who think sin and chant Hare Krishna to purify. But really, if the sins were so serious, how can one chanting of the holy name of God eradicate more sins than can be committed in one lifetime? That's what the Shastra says. So that means it's not that big of a deal for Krishna. For Krishna, it's not that big of a deal that we're so fallen and so on. It's not. Krishna just wants to see us try to surrender to him by the appropriate means. But we generally tend to become easily discouraged by the amount of anarthas in our heart and so on. That's Maya's business. Anyway, that discouragement can be useful when it leads to surrender to God, to surrender to Krishna. The first chapter of Bhagavad Gita is called Arjuna Vishada Yoga, traditionally. Vishada Yoga, Vishada means dejection. So the first chapter of Gita is called the Yoga of Dejection. And the idea is that when dejection leads to union with God, that becomes a form of yoga. Right? When dejection leads to taking shelter of God, that's a form of yoga. Yoga means to connect with God. So how can dejection be a form of connecting with God? In Kali Yuga, it's practically the main form of connecting to God. Krishna says there are four types of living entities who come to him. What are those four types? The distressed, the more distressed, the most distressed, and the superlatively distressed. In the age of Kali, practically no one comes to God for money, material remuneration. Why would I come to God for that? I can get a job, right? So no one thinks it's practical to come to God. Some Indians still believe like that, but that's becoming more and more rare. They hardly come for that also anymore. And hardly anyone comes because they're inquisitive. It's very rare to see someone deeply inquisitive. If they have some project for their classes, then they're inquisitive. They come and ask for, can you answer this question? Why do you wear this on your face? Why do you wear this color? What's that on the altar? What's that? Okay, thank you. And then they go away. That's not the inquisitiveness Krishna is speaking about in the Bhagavad Gita. So it's very rare you see someone coming because they're very inquisitive. And it's also very rare that it is extremely rare to see someone coming because they have knowledge of the absolute truth. And they're seeking more. But in Kali Yuga, it's very common to see someone coming because of distress to different degrees. So that becomes a form of yoga, Arjuna Vishada Yoga, when there's a lot of distress that leads to wanting to take shelter of the Supreme Lord. So Uddhava also is praying this way, that Nirvinandira, my mind is weary of material, and I'm tormented by endless distresses. Therefore, I've been so humbled by my experience that I'm now taking shelter of you, Krishna. He says this here. Then he gives different reasons why he's doing so. He says here, so I've told at one point, he gives a list of qualities of why he's taking shelter of Krishna, which is very beautiful and interesting. The first quality he mentions is that you're anavadyam, you're free from contamination. Your character is free from discrepancy. Therefore, I'm taking shelter of you. We may have often noticed that we tend to not want to take shelter of any living entity because we find so many discrepancies in their character, and that makes us doubtful. Even of devotees, we probably a lot of times projecting, but we see so many faults in their character, and therefore, why should I take shelter of a devotee? or Krishna. Actually, it works out together because to take shelter of Krishna means, especially in the initial stage, to take shelter of a devotee. Without taking shelter of a devotee, our taking shelter of Krishna is simply mental concoction. How you will take shelter of Krishna? In the initial stage, you have to learn what it means to take shelter of Krishna. So that means taking shelter of a devotee. Rupa Goswami describes it as the gateway of bhakti. But it is here that we find the most difficulty in gaining confidence. Because this point, anavadyam, you are free from contamination, therefore I'm taking shelter. Uddhava is saying that. When you see discrepancies in character, then you gain doubt about taking shelter. Of course, people find discrepancies in Krishna also. When there's some reversal in life, why would Krishna do this to me? I've been chanting a whole 16 rounds for 5 years without sleeping also. And now this reversal has come, and then you find a discrepancy. You find some fault with Krishna, you don't take shelter. The second quality he mentions here, and I'm just speaking according to the purport, is that Krishna is sarvajñam. Sarvajñam means he's omniscient. But here the way the purport reads is very beautiful. It says that Krishna never forgets what services you've done for him, so he's never ungrateful. And I've noticed that this comes up a lot with devotees. Many times we feel that people are forgetting our services, isn't it? Especially when we get chastised for something. Then we said, what about all these good things I've done? When I was doing so many good things, there was silence. You spoke nothing. And one little discrepancy comes and devotees are like hammering you. Not so much now. Nowadays, no devotees hammer us. In the old days, I don't think many of us would have survived. Even when I was getting trained up, I got a little bit of an old school training. And I never got glorification. I used to get mostly the sauce from Rivatinandana Prabhu. He would always remind me that I was indispensable. dispensable. He would remind me regularly, every day. It was like the Maha Mantra, and then this other mantra was, you're dispensable. Krishna doesn't need you. He would remind me that every day, and then I would be trying to do so many good things, and he would remain silent on that point. So many good things I was doing. I was rising at 2 in the morning. I was reading 2 hours, and he would say, you're getting puffed up. I would say, this is a good quality. I'm serious about spiritual life. He said, you think you're so advanced, don't you? Like that, the boys were quite strong, slamming our false egos. So then we tend to think that, oh, maybe they're forgetful of all the things that I've done. Therefore, why should I take shelter of them? But Krishna is described here as Savargyam. He's omniscient. He's never forgetful of even the tiniest service done to him. And therefore, he's never ungrateful. Actually, ingratitude is due to forgetfulness of what others have done for you. Which is sad because many times we are ungrateful towards devotees, completely forgetting all they have done for us. I don't know how it happens that, especially many of us have such horrible backgrounds where we've been rescued, but we forget all of that. And then the devotee does one little fault, and we're like, you know, Arjuna was called Sarvya Sachin. Right? Which means as he was shooting one arrow, his arm would be going back and getting the other one. So he was just shooting arrows like bullets. Devotee makes one little mistake and you're just nailing him to the wall or shooting him down like Bhishma. And we forget completely what all they have done for us. But Krishna is not like that, nor is his devotee. There's Sarvargyam. There's so many qualities here mentioned. I cannot describe all of them. My time is running out. So I'll mention these two. They're very nice points to consider. But anyway, the message is that Krishna is our protector. And, what about a devotee? A devotee is a protector only in that he helps us to take shelter of Krishna. By association with devotees, we get a sense of the greatness of God. Because a devotee is a devotee, according to Kaviraj Goswami in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, a devotee is actually a constituent of the Absolute Truth. So the manifestation of God means the simultaneous manifestation of the devotee. And the manifestation of the devotee means the simultaneous manifestation of God. So the devotees have been identified as an aspect of the Absolute Truth. So when we associate with devotees, we get a sense of the greatness of Krishna simultaneously. All the qualities in Krishna that would actually bring solace to the heart, we begin to find that in the Sangha of devotees because they are also parts of the Absolute Truth. Real devotees who are very highly advanced, particularly. Even the sadhakas provide some sense of that, but especially the perfected devotees. They are constituents of the Absolute Truth. So then by their association, we get a sense of the shelter of God. It is very hard for people to surrender to God just based on theoretical knowledge. They have to get an experience. Therefore, although many traditions, they all speak the same messages, not exactly the same philosophy they have, but the basic elements will be there in all traditions. God is the protector and so on. But many people don't find shelter in that. Therefore, they take shelter of sense gratification practically. And they can't stop also. Because you need a lot more than just the theoretical knowledge to take shelter of God. And the Sangha of devotees, they provide a sense of that experience of the shelter of God. And in that association, people are able to easily give up so many other things they were taking shelter of before that, just by associating with the devotees. So the devotees provide that medium. So only in that protection or shelter of God can there actually be solace with the heart. Without shelter, the soul becomes completely restless. Prabhupada would describe it as just like an airplane when it's flying in the sky. How long it can fly before it has to take shelter from the land? How long can it go on just flying around, zoom, zoom, zoom? Then the oil is getting low, isn't it? And then finally it has to take shelter of the land. So similarly, the living entity is like that. He's wandering all over the material world. Actually, he's wandering all over the material world looking for shelter. But only in his shelter in God will he actually find solace in his heart. And he begins to find that shelter in the association of devotees. You know, that should encourage us to become real devotees. So those people, by associating with us, if we become devotees, then people will actually feel the shelter of God and give up their sinful activity. Otherwise, if we don't find shelter in God, then Maya will bewilder us by thinking that that there is some other type of shelter, or that we can be a shelter for other living entities. And in that way, we remain captivated by material nature, and we remain in the material world by such thinking. That's Prabhupada's message, was like that here. So that's it. I'll stop. Anyone wants to ask anything or say anything? Okay, I saw Acharya's hand first.
Thank you, Vroom. One of the points you're mentioning is the nature of our absorption, that based on conditioning, even though someone may have done so much, but our mind immediately goes to something else. And you're developing that topic, but one question I had is noticing that in the initial, very early on in Krishna consciousness, our mind is able to be perhaps absorbed in the philosophy and things like this, but after some time also these previous impressions seem to become more prominent. Material desires, things we used to be absorbed in, these things are coming more in the mind. And I'm trying to determine, perhaps based on in light of a discussion like in Nectar of Devotion, we know how there's the cause of suffering is based on avidya, which leads to the seeds and this whole cycle. Is this a common thing that after time these things resurface, or is this indication?
Yeah, not that they resurface, they're there the whole time until you're sufficiently purified. But what happens is the mind is not focused on that in the beginning because of the new experience in Krishna consciousness is so profound. We've mentioned this point many times, that unless the mind gives attention to something, that thing does not gain much power. That tells us something about why our narches are so powerful, because we give a lot of attention to them. Therefore, they become powerful. Therefore, Prabhupada says the best way is to neglect the mind, but we find it hard to do that because the mind is like a kid screaming, "Don't you see me?" "Yes, I see you, I see you." And we give a lot of attention to it. What happens is, my analysis is that the anarchas are still there when we come. It's not like when we come to Krishna consciousness, all of a sudden a whole 50% of our lust just went away. It's like that without any practice and so on. But what happens is that the experience in Krishna consciousness is so profound that it takes away our attention from those negativity and brings our attention to Krishna. The kirtan is new. The prasadam is a festival for the tongue. The devotees are so sweet to us, right? They glorify me. That's something very odd experience. In the material world, no one glorifies you. They call you names, very bad names. But when you first come, devotees are usually so, they're sweet and they glorify you like, "Oh, wow, your writing is amazing. You actually wrote something very stupid." But the devotees said, "This is amazing." You know, that you have one little thing that's kind of resembled something that looked like Krishna consciousness. And the devotee just fanned that out. Like, "Wow, this is a very profound thing." And you feel so much like, "Wow, the devotees are so wonderful." It pulls your mind away from its absorption in anarthas and in matter. and brings your mind to Krishna. And so you you join up based on such attention to Krishna, actually. Where attention, how's the saying goes that Vaishnava Guru says? Attention goes, yeah, where attention goes, energy flows. So by those that new experience in Krishna consciousness, your attention is brought to Krishna, and so naturally your energy goes towards Krishna, not towards the darkness. But then what happens is by continued association, we become familiar with the Sangha of devotees, we become familiar with the philosophy, we become familiar with japa. I remember oftentimes it's not uncommon to hear devotees speak really far out and not true things when they first chant japa, you know. Many times we would do this at Northwestern at our programs. We would chant one round of japa together. And you ask people, what was your experience? And I felt that myself was coming out of my body. And they said like really far out stuff. And we were like, oh, very nice. You know, devotees are very encouraging. And then that same japa you find completely horrible after some time. You're like, man, when is this going to get over? It's taking so long, a whole 2 hours. And like that. What happened to that wonderful experience in the beginning and now? So you become familiar with the chanting of the holy name of Krishna. You become familiar with the prasadam. Oftentimes we've seen that even Vishwakarma will whip up something that, you know, is not the standard that devotees may be generally used to eating. You know, Vishwakarma would whip up something in the last minute for the college program. And the devotees were thinking, oh man, the prasadam is not like, I don't know if the people are going to be inspired by this. And they go and they eat it and they're like, this is amazing. All the devotees in the temple were complaining about it, you know. The same preparation, all the devotees in the temple were complaining. This was this problem. They had so many problems with it. That same prasadam you bring in the college, many times it's happened, especially at Loyola, I would feel like this sometimes. Like, oh man, I don't know about the prasadam. And they were like, this is the most amazing preparation I ever had. What? Really? It's bitter melon. You know, it's amazing because it's fried and it's got certain... people are not used to putting like sufficient salt and spices on their food. You know, they find it quite amazing experience. That same prasadam which we so much glorified in the beginning, we find so much fault with it later on. Actually, we commit a lot of offenses to a prasadam. To make a comment about prasadam is offensive. You're not supposed to say anything about it. It's the mercy of Krishna. You're not supposed to make any comment. Even to say that this is tasting so wonderful, it can be dangerous. In the beginning, we encourage, when we're neophyte, go on glorifying. When the general mentality is that I'm enjoying the prasadam, that's a very dangerous idea because the mood is supposed to be honoring prasadam. Therefore, historically, devotees would have someone read during prasadam time and would be quiet. So that the tendency to think that prasadam is just meant for your enjoyment becomes a little bit low. Anyway. So that same prasadam we'll tend to criticize, oh, it doesn't have sufficient salt. Oh, I don't like that. Making some criticism. What happened? The same things which you were finding so much inspiration to surrender your life to Krishna in the beginning, you find hardly any inspiration later on. And then when you don't find inspiration there, then the mind drifts back to the other dark situation, which it had actually forgotten due to the strong pull of a higher attraction in the beginning stages. So then the root cause of that is inattention. See, in the beginning, it is easy to be attentive because it's a new experience. But then later on, you are forced to work hard at putting proper attention to the thing. Just like, maybe it's something like having a child. I think I can use this analogy because it is used by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur in the first canto. It's something like he compares bhakti to a young baby in the beginning. Shraddha is compared to like a young infant. And in the beginning, you require a lot of attention also, even when a young infant. So with your shraddha, there's attention required. But as the baby is getting older, so much more attention is required. Because in the beginning stages, like with an infant, I'm using this infant analogy, the baby is just with you. But later on, he starts moving around, he starts exploring the material world. So you have to work so much harder to keep the child in check. So something like that, I'm using it as a parallel here. In the beginning, it's kind of easy, but later on, you require more work in order to keep the same heart in the right place. And oftentimes, we don't do that work. And that's usually due to pride. We think we've understood it, we've got it, and we're familiar. We become a little proud. And from there, we become offensive. From pride, then you become offensive. And then from offenses, then the mind is forced back into the other situation. Krishna kicks you out. Lord Chaitanya doesn't mind us being so fallen, but if you commit offenses, especially to Vaishnavas, then Lord Chaitanya will kick you out. And one place in the Chaitanya Bhagavat, Maharu says that through your chanting of the holy name, he will kick you out. Through the chanting of the holy name, he will expel you from the, if you commit offenses. So you can say, in one sense, our hard work as sadhakas is how to just give up our offensive mentality, which is usually due to pride, which is usually due to inattention and becoming overfamiliar with things. So I would say like that, it's not that the darkness goes away so quickly. It's not so easy to get rid of lusty desires. I mean, I think we have practical experience with that. But our attention, we don't give attention to them in the beginning because the higher attraction is so powerful. But later on, due to negligence and the hard work of remaining attentive to that, then becoming proud, becoming offensive, and then being pushed back into the negative absorption again, and then becoming discouraged. I know that's my experience for sure. I can count for very specific events like that where I've had this experience. I don't know if that satisfies the question. This is my answer. Okay, Luke, you want to say something? We have a few more minutes left.
Hare Krishna. Thank you, Ru. You're mentioning how the soul actually has nothing to do with the material existence that we find ourselves in. What is the principle that allows us to maintain this realization, or at least the theoretical understanding, but at the same time not be so detached that we can't...
The desire of Krishna coming through the order of the spiritual master. So you'll find that devotees are also very active in the material world. It's not like they're, okay, I'm a spirit, so I have nothing to do with it. I'm just going to lay here. You do find some examples of that in Bhagavatam, but generally you don't see that devotees are very active in the material world. So how is it that they're able to do activity when they know they have all this knowledge, just like Gyanis? The Gyanis seem to become inactive, and the devotees have the same knowledge, but they're so active. And the difference between a Gyani and a devotee is the desire to please Krishna, to fulfill Krishna's desire. So, for example, Krishna's coming to the material world millennium after millennium to establish Dharma. Dharma samstarpanataya, Krishna says this. And Kali Yuga's Yuga Dharma is there and so on. So then the devotee's desire is to assist Krishna in fulfilling his desires. So that principle of satisfying the desire of Krishna through the order of the spiritual master as it's coming down through the parampara, that allows a devotee to be detached from the material existence and at the same time be very active within it. Like Srila Prabhupada coming to America, I don't think he was attached to America and all the sinful living entities here. I find it hard to believe that that could be the case. And at the same time, he was so active, especially in the beginning half of his preaching mission. He was so much in America. How is it possible? And he was undergoing tremendous hardships, unbelievable austerities, 2 heart attacks. It doesn't even take a heart attack for me to be discouraged to go outside. Just like, I hurt my foot and I'm ready to, you know, call it quits for the day, right? I don't want to go out. It has to be something very, I wake up and I have a little bit of a sneeze. I say, okay, I think I'm getting sick. I'll miss Mangalarti today. So just to make sure I don't fall on it. It's something very small we get discouraged. Prabhupada had 2 heart attacks. This is inconceivable. And then he didn't lose enthusiasm. And then he came for 1 year. I always try to think about 1 year, nothing was happening in his programs. Imagine we're doing Northwestern. Imagine we're doing all this work, every week making prasadam, and no one comes for a whole year. I'll probably stop the program. Not even, I wouldn't have to wait a whole year. 1 quarter, finish. You know, no one came. I'll lose hope, you know, very quickly. A whole year Prabhupada was working. How is it that he was able to work so hard despite the tremendous difficulties? And also he wasn't attached to America. He could have just stayed in Vrindavan. It was very nice for him and so on. Because of the desire of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta, which was the desire of Krishna coming through Srila Bhaktisiddhanta. So your question is, how does a devotee maintain practical awareness of these principles? For a neophyte devotee, we may not be able to actually practically have that realization on the foreground. But the interesting thing about devotional service is that just by trying to satisfy the desire of Krishna coming to the spiritual master, you're actually acting on that platform of realization. To the degree you keep that in the foreground of your practical activity, then to that degree, that realization is actually becoming reinforced. And that's the unique thing about devotional service. What is that verse we say? Vasudeve Bhagavati Bhakti Yoga Prayojitaha. You know this verse? Dhanayati Ashu Vairagyam Gyanam Chayara Haitukam. That just by devotional service, then Gyan and Vairagya will come as ornaments later on without even trying for them. And so what is the principle of Bhakti Yoga? Satisfying the desire of Krishna. You know, satisfying the desire of spiritual man. That's the main principle. So just by focusing on that one principle, you become ornamented with so many other qualities and knowledge and so on. So it seems to me that's how a devotee is able to do it. But how, you know, to the degree that the devotee takes that seriously.
It just seems quite unpalatable, especially the analogy of it's a drama. It's just drama. The living entities are like actors. You remember this analogy?
I remember.
It seems unpalatable because...
Well, you mean to say that to hear that the material world is totally insubstantial is unpalatable. Everything I'm doing in the material world is totally useless and insubstantial and a waste of time is unpalatable.
Exactly.
Yeah, it is. For the conditioned mind, most certainly. Imagine going, we go to the university, and these students are working hard as anything. They're spending $50,000 plus a year. And the devotees, we come on our high horses, it is all useless. You know, they immediately attack you. I was mentioning, you remember last year, I was mentioning this to Madhavendra Puri Prabhu yesterday, we were having a lot of laugh about this. Remember Radha and Alyssa and Michael, they were coming, three scientists were coming to our program. And I was, after our kirtan, I would give like a little talk. And I just made like a slight, it was an ever so slight critique of evolution theory. And Radha of all people, her hair just went zzz, like the Putana witch, and she just manifested a whole nother form. She was so sweet ordinarily, but it was just like the slightest little evolution is like, you know, little tiny little critique. And her hair, her hair like turned on fire. And then Alyssa seeing Radha, she became inspired, and she turned into a Putana witch too. So, and I'm not Krishna, so I was scared, you know, oh no. And then their friend Michael, he was just peaceful. He didn't say anything. I said, thank you. You know, I had three Putana witches manifesting. And they were just, they flared up. Just because it was a small critique of the viability of evolution. But by saying that, what I was inadvertently saying is that whatever they were doing was useless. You know, that you're wasting your time and mental speculation. It leads to nowhere. So naturally, that naturally can, you know, make you a little bit upset. So it is unpalatable for the conditioned soul to hear that he's wasting his time in the material existence. That is very unpalatable. You have to be a little bit sober. You know, for sober persons, they actually come to that conclusion themselves. It's not uncommon to find many students understanding that they're wasting their time in school. That's not an uncommon phenomenon these days. It would probably be most uncommon amongst the scientists. Typically minded, because they're really absorbed in a lot of... But Mother Donna Kelly describes like that she had this like premonition or this epiphany. One day she was doing some work in the lab she was describing to us, and she realized, she just said, this is a complete waste of time. You know how Mother Donna Kelly speaks very heavily, very inspiringly, you know, heavy. And she said, and when she had that realization, she said Krishna made her suffer for 3 months with that realization before she came to the Christian lunch and picked up a magazine. I think it was the Origins magazine, the first magazine she read, cover to cover, she was describing to me. She said Krishna made her suffer with that feeling for 3 months that she was completely wasting her life. So it was not uncommon for people to come to this realization themselves. Generally, they don't find it as unpalatable when they come to that realization themselves as they would if they were here from a devotee. Especially if that devotee is not humble. Because generally, we're very enthusiastic to tell people they're wasting their lives. Isn't it? Because now we're doing the right thing, right? So we become fired up to tell people they're wasting their time. So when a devotee is not humble and he speaks, it is very dangerous. When he's not actually Vaishnava, when he speaks, it can create a lot of problems for himself also and for the living entity. Someone may be inspired to hurt you. When a devotee is very humble and he speaks this way, people get inspired, in fact. It is not uncommon to see a very deeply humble Vaishnava express the same thing in his own sort of way, and people become inspired to surrender to Krishna. So at least as practicing devotees, it should not be unpalatable. It should encourage us to surrender to Krishna. We're practicing devotees. We're not just like the regular mojos, the John Doe's outside. We're practicing devotees, so to hear about the insubstantiality of the material world is meant to encourage us to take shelter of Krishna. We should find great inspiration in those messages, because Krishna repeats them again and again and again and again and again throughout the whole entirety of the Bhagavatam. That is one of the primary messages of the insubstantial nature of the material existence. So that is supposed to give us encouragement, actually, to take shelter of Krishna. So I don't think you should be finding it so unpalatable.
Especially in terms of our interpersonal relationships.
Well, that's a little bit different. Okay, interpersonally, you mean with persons who are not devotees? Well, you mean even with devotees? No, so that means we're working under some misconceptions. The relationship with devotees are not material things. They're not aspects of the material existence. When you're functioning with Krishna in the center, those relationships are eternal. And they lead to eternal existence. The eternal, I don't mean to say by eternal, I don't mean to indicate that you're necessarily going to be with that jiva eternally, per se. That is up to Krishna. But by eternal, I mean to say that those types of relationships are actually on the platform of sat, which means eternal or eternal existence. So when we relate to devotees in terms of Krishna consciousness, sharing Krishna katha with one another, etc., reminding one another of Krishna, that relationship is completely different from the material existence. And it actually leads to Godhead, which is proof that it's not of the nature of matter. We discuss this verse in Gita Nagari, it's a famous verse, that both by the rising and the setting of the sun, both by the rising and the setting, the sun steals away the life of everyone, except for those who are absorbed in Harikata. So then one may say, how is that possible? Because obviously the body is, we're doing Harikata every day, body is still growing old. How's it, you know, one, there's many ways this is actually, I'll mention 2 points, Vishwanacharya Thakur's point. Because the body is growing old, we're doing Harikata every day. Do you feel that the body is still growing old and everything is happening? This Bhagavatam verse says you'll be completely free from the time factor just by absorbing Harikata. But it doesn't look like it to me. I see these bags are coming, you know, slowly. I can already see that as an old man, it's going to be tough and rough and scruff. You know, I can see it now in my youth. So how is it that time is not affecting the devotees? One point is that because by constant engagement and Harikata in that way, the time factor is actually pushing you towards Godhead. When you're engaged in matter, time factor is pushing you towards your next body. And when you're engaged in Harikata exclusively throughout the day, then time factor is actually pushing towards the spiritual kingdom. Because certainly at the time of death, you'll be similarly absorbed, you'll go back home, back to Godhead. And the other reason that Vishwanacharya Thakur gives, which is very interesting, he says that the time factor apparently destroying the material body, he said actually it is true that when you're absorbed in Harikata, you're actually completely free from the influences of time. Vishwanacharya Thakur says it's actually true. He says the appearance of the destruction of the body is meant to give impetus to the devotee to take deeper shelter of Krishna. That's what Vishwanacharya Thakur says. He says, due to the devastation of the material bodies, the devotee actually becomes more deeply attached to Krishna. So in that way, Krishna as a time factor devastating the material body is meant to actually deepen our relationship with him and our tendency to take shelter of him. That's a very interesting and beautiful point as well. So that our interpersonal relationships do not need to be... If we exchange with each other on the platform of talking prajalpa and joking around with one another frivolously, which we tend to do, especially as young men, the senses are uncontrolled, so we tend to relate to one another on a mundane platform, then that type of relationship is of the material existence. And it leads to nowhere. It leads to degradation, you know, subtly. But if we stick to the principle of always speaking about Krishna, those are spiritual relationships. And they're not of material existence. So I.
It's like when you observe other people's bodies becoming like old.
Well, specifically your own body.
Your own body.
Other people's bodies growing old doesn't impact us that much. We see old people all the time. We don't give a crap about it, right? Actually, Pashanapina Pashati, right? You know this verse from the Bhagavatam? Pashanapina Pashati means seeing but not examining. Pashanapina Pashati means seeing but not examining. So many times when we're driving to downtown in Sankirtan, right when we get to Lakeshore and Hollywood, you know, Hollywood and Sheridan, where Lakeshore Drive is there, right there is the old age home is there. Right, so it's very common to see old people walking around that place. And many times you can see them crossing the street and it's taking them a long time. Sometimes they hold up the traffic, you know. The light turns green, you want to go to Lakeshore Drive, but this old lady is there with the walker. And, you know, she puts the walker out, step. Take a breath. Puts the walker out, step. Take a breath. Puts the walker out, step. Take a breath. You know, the whole traffic, and everyone, the cars in the back who can't see you, they're getting mad, you know, so they're hitting the horns very heavy, but you can't do anything because you got to wait for the old lady across the street. And that doesn't even register in our mind. Nothing happens to the mind. We don't examine that, like, that's going to happen to me. You know, that's what's coming up in the future. Nothing happened. Everyone's just sitting there and they start speaking prajalpa with each other. You know, they take whatever little extra time to fill it in with some prajalpa. Okay, we got to wait another 10 minutes. Let's just talk something nonsense. And then, okay, finally she's gone. Let's go. But actually, if you were to see and examine that, I was on the train yesterday and it was the first time. I was like examining things. I was chanting Hare Krishna and there were some people by me. They were speaking all sorts of nonsense and it was really just, I wanted to say shut up, but the guy was like way bigger than me. So I did not dare to say anything. Actually, both the guys that were talking, they were huge, you know. So I kept my mouth shut. But I was really annoyed. They were speaking so much that I can't share it. It was just so much nonsense. And one girl was there also. She was really, because the guys had to impress her. There was one girl, and she was much younger than them. So they were wanting to impress her, so they were speaking more foolish things. Generally, when you want to impress a girl, you speak foolishly. And somehow she gets attracted by that, apparently, in Kali Yuga. Anyway, the observation. So I was just observing things yesterday, and I was getting like, man, I think to go back home about the Godhead just to have a good conversation, you know, just so there could be a meaningful conversation, we should go back home about the Godhead. In Kali Yuga, don't expect to talk to many intelligent people. In fact, when we meet someone who can understand the difference between the body and soul in Sankirtan, you feel so jubilant. You feel like prema is coming upon your heart. You've understood this point? You know, your hair starts standing, Wormoncha Kampa, Shu Taranga Bhaja. You know, you feel really ecstatic that someone can get it. But it's very common, especially at the university, very common people argue with you. But how do you know the microphone isn't conscious? Are you serious? And how are you supposed to explain it to them? They argue in this way. Devotees, we have no good argument. They say, how do you know that? The car can be conscious too. Many times we'll say, just like the car is not conscious. How do you know? What do you mean, it's obvious it's not conscious. No, you don't know. Maybe it is conscious. It gives so much rhetoric like this. So you meet someone like that, you feel inspired. Anyway, so the point is that we don't usually get so inspired by other people's bodies being destroyed because we don't examine existence so carefully. So Vishnath Chakravarti is talking about the devastation of our own body, which we're very attentive to. We're very attentive to our own material bodies. So he's speaking about that. By seeing your own material body and mind becoming attacked by decrepitude, then the devotee becomes inspired to take shelter of Krishna more substantially. Just like Bhaktivinoda Thakura writes Sharanagati at the end of his life. Of course, Bhaktivinoda Thakura is not a conditioned soul like us. But he's showing at the end of his life, he's writing this thing, saying that now by my old age, I'm being forced to consider surrender to you. So old age is very, if you're a devotee, old age is very useful. One thing is that you can't do much else but chant and hear about Krishna as the body gets older and older and older. You know, you don't have the physical capacity to do so many wild things. Like in the youth. hopefully by that time you would have developed taste for chanting Hare Krishna. That means you have to work hard now for Krishna. Also work hard in practicing intentional chanting now. So if you, it so happens that you grow old, it's possible that many of us might grow old and be stuck in these bodies for many years to come. If you grow old and you have no taste for chanting and hearing, then your life will be finished. Not totally finished, but you'll be in a dangerous situation because the body can't do much of anything else. So you see how many people become senile now in their old age. They go crazy. They're neglected and no one cares for them. So if you've not become sufficiently attached to the holy name and to the Hari Katha, then old age is going to be very rough. So anyway, old age health is useful for a devotee. Everything is useful for a devotee. That was the idea. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Gauru Pranandi Hari Om.